2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio with the 21st Century Perspective on History's Greatest Rock Album. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, Bono, The Edge, Adam Clayton, and Larry Mullen Jr. Mark, U2 declared war.
I think War was a very important record for us. I think it sort of set up the mood that led eventually to Live 8 and things like that. It was very uncool at the time of the War album to be in any way politicised or to have strong feelings on such matters. Nothing changes.
Well, I think all music is political. Everything. I mean, Madonna's political. Just so happens that, you know, when we write songs, sometimes we're more obvious, you know, we're drawing on ideas and we're allowing our anger at times or our feelings about things to come out in a way that probably people can recognize as it being more political. But I don't think you can draw lines and say some music is political, some isn't. I think it all is.
Many of the first quarter releases in 1983 went on to become iconic rock blockbusters, including Def Leppard Pyromania, Journey Frontiers, ZZ Top Eliminator, and David Bowie Let's Dance. But the Irish quartet U2, who had shown flashes of potential earlier with I Will Follow and Gloria, declared war with a fiery earnestness in the songs Sunday Bloody Sunday, New Year's Day, Two Hearts Beat as One, Surrender, and the concert highlight 40. From our vantage point today, there is all of this revisionist history as if there were these high expectations in March 1983 for the Dublin Quartet and that third album, War, when in actuality, all we had seen were those two flashes of brilliance, I Will Follow and Gloria, albeit a year apart, with the rousing martial rhythms from Larry Mullen Jr.'s drums on the opening to Sunday Bloody Sunday, and that tortured passion evident in Bono's voice over the Edge's stiletto guitar stabs on New Year's Day, and Adam Clayton's rolling bass on Surrender, as well as Two Hearts Beat as One. War by U2 was a musical proclamation of a serious contender on the unfolding 80s rock vista. Rolling Stone magazine ranks U2's War album at number 223 on the list of top 500 albums of all time. Yet, for all of its social and musical import, U2 drummer Larry Mullen Jr. reminds all of us that far from changing the arc of popular music or politics in the 80s, Larry was just trying not to screw up the recording.
I was just trying to learn the drum parts, to be honest. And, it's just, you know, it's difficult to look back and, you know, Bono writes the words, and the words are what people remember sometimes about those records. No, I think, you know, the stance that was taken. So it's kind of, I find it kind of difficult to look back and remember that. Being in the studio is can be a bit brain numbing. So it's the sort of thing sometimes you just put to the back of your mind. So I actually have very few memories of that time. I remember the road, been on the road, but I don't remember the studios.
You don't remember recording Sunday Bloody Sunday?
I did. That's the only song. That's the only song I do remember recording. Yeah.
Oh,
U2's third album, War, in 1983, opened with Sunday, Bloody Sunday. It was first performed in the Northern Ireland city of Belfast, the epicenter of bloodshed between Protestant loyalists to Great Britain and Irish Catholics bent on home rule. I found it surprising that a mere 5 years after 11 souls died at a Who concert in Cincinnati, and it effectively eliminated general admission from Americans' concert arenas, U2 brought the European standard general admission floor back to concerts in America again. Commenting on it was first Bono, then Adam Clayton, and then The Edge of U2.
The thing that actually about rock and roll in America is that up until grunge, it wasn't physical. Those venues, you know, they had seats in them. It was really difficult to get the groove. It was really difficult to have the rise and fall, you know, like the waves breaking that we were used to in the smaller venues. When we went to arenas, it got really tricky. And that's, I think that's why there had to be, that's why Nirvana, that's why these bands had to come and find a way of making rock and roll physical. It's also, it's supposed to be like dance music. As well, that's another thing. That's the next step. So when can you actually get the groove going through a venue? It's you know, it's not supposed to be sitting there or indeed standing on the seats. It's supposed to be more physical.
Yeah, we didn't really know about kind of incitement to riot laws because that's what we thought a gig was. And you know, in Europe, it was all GA and standing up and stuff. So that was difficult playing the arena and knowing you had to stay on the stage.
Bono used to vanish from stage quite regularly, which was a bit disconcerting.
It's an attempt to get Edge to play a guitar.
Suddenly your singer is gone and you're, okay, where is he? Is he about to come back? Is he on a 10-minute jaunt to the back of the venue? It was a strange time. I seem to remember a couple of times where Bono would leave and you'd literally be there for about 15 minutes and he'd come back completely out of breath. And you discover that he'd gone for a pizza or
he'd gone
off somewhere and interviewed some of the members of the audience. It was a strange time.
The Song by U2 is a great driving tune overlooked on the album War. Their third album entered the UK charts at number one. Here's singer-lyricist Bono.
War, we were coming from the John Lennon sort of handbook school of songwriting, you know, get a statement, find a backbeat, mm-hmm. and that's all you need. And I think War was a very important record for us. I think it sort of set up the mood that led eventually to Live 8 and things like that. It was very uncool at the time of the War album to be in any way politicized or to have strong feelings on such matters. And I remember having rows and arguments with Bob Geldof, you know, who did Live Aid, mm-hmm. and people like String, you know, Sting and the Police, because he was saying, look, music is pop music, you know, it's beauty. And it was just a very uncool position that we found ourselves in. But it was that they were convictions. And it was our way of making sense of being in the band. Actually, I think if we didn't feel we could speak like that, I think that would have been the end of it for us then, because we were on to, you know, to take to the streets. We had our marching boots on, and you know, the '80s is a very selfish period in history. It's gone down as the greed is good and all of those kinds of things, but. There we were, right in the middle of it, with stony faces, looking like the band, you know, too stupid to enjoy being at number one.
The Numbing Horror of War with Love Missing in Action. That's U2's New Year's Day. Coming up next in the studio, The Edge and Bono respond to the question of whether music should be political. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard. You're in the studio for the anniversary since U2 declared war. Should pop music reflect a political point of view? Here's guitarist-songwriter The Edge, followed by Bono of U2.
I think all music is political. Everything. I mean, Madonna's political. Just so happens that, you know, when we write songs, sometimes we're more obvious, you know, we're drawing on ideas and we're allowing our anger at times or our feelings about things to come out in a way that probably people can recognize as it being more political. But I don't think you can draw lines and say some music is political, some isn't. I think it all is, but it's just speaking about different things.
Myself and Adam were talking the other night about that tune, When a Man Loves a Woman.
Mm-hmm.
Is that Percy Sledge? Isn't it?
Percy Sledge.
Okay. We're saying, well, there's a pop tune, but it's not a pop tune. It's a political tune because that was sung by a black male, okay, coming out of the ghetto, talking about his belief in relationships and not wanting to follow the cliched route, that his ethnic tribe expect of him. He's, you know, believing in it. It's political. And all the great rock and roll music and pop music in the end is political.
I don't know my right from left.
Two Hearts beat as over a million. U2's War album sold over 1 million copies on its way to the number 12 chart position in the U.S. Bono's 2020 Hindsight analyzes U2's reaction to the sudden success of their third album.
I think one thing is not to be defensive, and we've been very defensive in the past. Again, I think that's an Irish thing. You know, if your back's up against the wall, you can get quite aggressive. And even musically speaking, this has been true. And that appears to some people as pompous, you know, like, or, you know, not giving access or precious, you know, that kind of thing. I think we've learned that we actually have, in the end, we've nothing to hide, you know, as a band. So why don't we just kind of, you know, maybe we should, you know, a bit of glasnost could go this way, and this particular gang of four has nothing to hide. So we just kind of, I don't know, we had to let go of something. I don't quite know what it was that we were letting go. We were holding on to the group too tightly. And I think it came across, it made the music a little too taut, it made squeeze my voice. And it was just coming out of Dublin, coming out of Ireland, not knowing how the hell to be in a rock and roll band, not knowing what you should do, not wanting to get ripped off, not wanting to get, you know, all, not wanting to fall into those traps, and kind of not being very loose about it. And
that's understandable, though.
Yeah, but that's just, I'm just, that's, if there's one thing I'd regret of the 80s, it was just an uptightness. And it was an uptightness that sharpened our music on a lot of levels, but it spoiled our own enjoyment of it.
Cities of lights with logos and lies, and right
There's another gem from the War album buried deep inside called Surrender from U2. Up next, Larry Mullen Jr., Bono, and The Edge all fess up to missteps and myths in the studio, U2's War. An album which Rolling Stone music writers ranked at number 223 on the top 500 albums of all time. I'm Redbeard. The mythology that started after the success of the War album would build throughout the 1980s, but U2's Larry Mullen Jr. says that some in the rock press were a bit overzealous, maybe even self-serving, in what the writers ascribed to the band. Here's Larry, followed by Bono, in the studio.
This whole thing of the conscience of rock and roll and whatever was just this heap just thrown at us. And it took us a long time to actually get over that. And we spent a lot of time trying to explain it and justify it and justify our position, because it's not what we were trying to do or what we were trying to say. And it just, it became this big, big thing.
It was the life of Brian.
Yeah, it was very,
like,
very
heavy. You know, we're not the Messiah.
We're just very naughty boys.
but it's also important that you don't back off either. And what happened in... What we helped, I think, start in the 80s was a kind of positive protest movement that was kind that brought about things like Live Aid and brought about things like the conspiracy of Hope Tour, and we're very proud of those things.
We should be.
And our own audience are very effective politically. And, you know, the Amnesty International doubled its membership after that tour.
Oh, that's terrific. Our
audience is made up of, you know, we think they're really smart, and kind of some of them just want to get involved and roll up the sleeves. We still feel as angry as we ever felt. We've just got better at disguising it.
Even with its breakthrough success, U2 decided that they needed to push their stark sound on the War album even further on their studio follow-up, The Unforgettable Fire. Here's The Edge, then Bono, in the studio.
I think we thought that there was a lot of stuff we could do in the studio that we hadn't really fully realized on our first three records. And so it was a conscious decision to move away from a kind of upfront, hard-edged sound from like we had on the War album into something a lot more textural and a lot more experimental, because we really were interested in that as well. You know, we're greedy. We wanted that aspect to be known and to be developed. We didn't want to be just a band known for doing, you know, really hard-edged, straightforward political songs.
I never even bought into the hard-edged thing because I don't think we sounded that hard. You know, even though we are f***ing hard. Do you know what I'm saying? It was always never punk rock, you know. It was like we always wanted to trip out, and we weren't on drugs. Do you know what I mean? We were just high on ourselves and being in a band and coming out of Dublin and going to London and Paris and Amsterdam, these cities. We were drunk on each other, and we were never going to be some boring, you know, meat and potatoes punk band. And I think what we felt like after war. I hate any record where I'm shooting my mouth off. It's really hard to live with, because, you know, if you're a singer, when I'm singing, you can tell, you know, you can tell some, a singer's voice is always going to be a giveaway, even in their conversation. You know they're shitting you, you know, you just always know with this. And whenever I hear myself talking on a record, I just don't
cringe.
I just don't buy it.
This is Redbeard in the studio thanking my guest, U2. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions. Copyright 2018, all rights reserved. Transcription by Jane Carpenter Brune. Theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter and online at inthestudio.net.